You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. David and the chiefs of the service, also set apart for the service, sons of Asaph, and of Heman, and of Jeduthun, who prophesied with lyres, with harps, and with cymbals. The list of those who did the work, and of their duties, was of the sons of Asaph, Zakur, Joseph, Nethaniah, and Asharela. Sons of Asaph, under the direction of Asaph, who prophesied under the direction of the king. Of Jeduthun, the sons of Jeduthun, Gedaliah, Ziri, Jeshiah, Shimei, Hashabiah, and Mattathiah, 6, under the direction of their father Jeduthun, who prophesied with the lyre in thanksgiving and praise to Yahweh. Of Heman, the sons of Heman, Bukiah, Mattaniah, Uziel, Shebuel, and Jeremoth, Hananiah, Hanani, Eliatha, Gedaltai, and Ramamti Ezer, Joshbekashah, Maloti, Hotir, Mahazioth. All these were the sons of Heman, the king's seer, according to the promise of God to exalt him, for God had given Heman 14 sons and 3 daughters. They were all under the direction of their father in the music in the house of Yahweh, with cymbals, harps, and lyres, for the service of the house of God. Asaph, Jeduthun, and Heman were under the order of the king. The number of them, along with their brothers, who were trained in singing to Yahweh, all who were skillful, was 288. And they cast lots for their duties, small and great, teacher and pupil alike. The first lot fell for Asaph to Joseph, the second to Gedaliah, to him and his brothers and his sons, 12. The third to Zakur, his sons and his brothers, 12. The fourth to Izri, his sons and his brothers, 12. The fifth to Nethaniah, his sons and his brothers, 12. The sixth to Bukiah, his sons and his brothers, 12. The seventh to Jeshiela, his sons and his brothers, 12. The eighth to Jeshiah, his sons and his brothers, 12. The ninth to Mattaniah, his sons and his brothers, 12. The tenth to Shimei, his sons and his brothers, 12. The 11th to Azarel, his sons and his brothers, 12. The 12th to Hashabiah, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 13th, Shebuel, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 14th, Mattathiah, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 15th, to Jeremoth, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 16th, to Hananiah, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 17th, to Joshbekashah, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 18th, to Hanani, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 19th, to Maloti, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 20th, to Eliatha, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 21st, to Hothir, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 22nd, to Gedalti, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 23rd, to Mahazioth, his sons and his brothers, 12. To the 24th, to Ramamti Ezer, his sons and his brothers, 12. Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 843 of this podcast. Today is Saturday, April 13th, 2024. And that was a reading of 1 Chronicles chapter 25 in the Old Testament. We'll talk about it in just a moment. But before we do, a little preview of what else we're going to be discussing in this episode. We're going to talk about what if really, really weird Bible verses were made into praise and worship songs? What if? Would we sing them if we looked around at church and we saw that everybody else was singing them? Would we really lean into singing them, even if the lyrics were super weird, as long as the quality of the music was such to evoke a certain emotion that we want to feel, that we associate with being pious and worshipful? We'll talk about it. I'm not going to give away the answer, but it's yes. Dollar stores shutting down across America. That also will be a topic in this episode. Guess what? It's their fault. It's the fault of the dollar stores that they're going under. Also, 2025 Social Security COLA estimate rises due to inflation. COLA not being the bubbly soft drink, but rather cost of living. The cost of living assessment is rising. Go figure. That's probably also the fault of the dollar stores or old people. Let's blame the old people, just not living within their means. You know, old people who are just notorious for wasting their money, spending too much of it, need to have a talk with those old people about being more frugal. Lastly, what we're going to spend the majority of our time at the end of this episode discussing is this news out of Arizona regarding a Civil War era abortion ban, which the Supreme Court of that state has just reimposed or reinstated, or they've reminded everybody is still on the books, but nobody was enforcing it. Some big names are weighing in on this. Actually, the biggest name in politics is weighing in on this, and not in the way I wish he was. We'll get to it when we get to it. But just for now, I'll say we are going to have a conversation about abortion bans statewide and also nationwide, all of that and more. We'll discuss in this episode. But first, let's turn to Matthew Henry's commentary on 1 Chronicles chapter 25. Matthew Henry, a quick reminder about him. I know I've talked about his bio and backstory before, but I want to delve into it a little bit as a refresher, or for those who are new to this podcast and didn't hear the bio before, this might be new information. So here you go. Matthew Henry, the Reverend Matthew Henry, was born 1662 in Flintshire, Wales. He passed away in 1714 in Nantwich, Cheshire, at the age of 51. He was the father of 9 children. How about that? And he was a nonconformist minister. In fact, he was a very well-educated, very properly educated nonconformist minister. His father had been a nonconformist minister before him, and his dad had means and so was able to pay for the best schooling for young Matthew when he was a youth, when he was a young man. And Matthew Henry, for his part, put it to good use, writing, among other things, some excellent commentaries on the Bible, even though they are round about 315 years old. I really rather enjoy them. In fact, I would consider them to be my favorite commentaries I've come across, because he thinks through passages in a way that makes sense to me. I know the language is a little old-timey for most modern readers, but hopefully you'll be able to appreciate what it is that he has to say about this chapter and many others, as we refer to him on occasion, to help us to understand what the Bible is communicating, what it's describing. What does Matthew Henry say about chapter 25? Well, first, and I quote, "David, having settled the courses of these Levites that were to attend the priests in their ministrations, proceeds in this chapter to put those into a method that were appointed to be singers and musicians in the temple. Here is, 1, the persons that were to be employed, Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun." And by the way, while we're here, there's a Bible name that somebody needs to bring back. Heman is a Bible name, and why is nobody using that as a baby name. Maybe my wife and I will have another son at some point, Lord willing, and maybe we'll name him He-Man. I wouldn't hold your breath because my wife probably will not be agreeable to that idea, but it'll be fun to try and talk her into it anyways. Asaph, He-Man, and Jeduthun, verse 1, their sons, verses 2 to 6, and other skillful persons, verse 7. And that just goes to show that skillful is not the opposite of spiritual. It is okay to say, hey, this is not your thing. Why don't you serve over there in some other capacity? The music kind of needs to be the people who are good at the music thing, and you can make a joyful noise down there, and we're going to make a joyful noise that is also skillful up here because this is what we're good at. That's okay. That's not unchristian to set things up in that way at all. Here we find attention paid to who is skilled at the music thing, and it's okay. It's totally okay. In fact, it's good. 2, the order in which they were to attend determined by lot, verses 8 to 31. Regarding verses 1 to 7 in this chapter, Matthew Henry writes, observe, 1, singing the praises of God is here called prophesying, verses 1 to 3. Not that all those who were employed in this service were honored with the visions of God, or could foretell things to come. He-Man, indeed, is said to be the king's seer, in the words of God, verse 5, but the psalms they sang were composed by the prophets, and many of them were prophetical, and the edification of the church was intended in it, as well as the glory of God. In Samuel's time, singing the praises of God went by the name of prophesying, 1 Samuel 10, verse 5, 19, verse 20, and perhaps that is intended in what St. Paul calls prophesying, 1 Corinthians 11, 4, 14, 24. 2, this is here called a service, and the persons employed in it, workmen, verse 1, not but that it is the greatest liberty and pleasure to be employed in praising God, what is heaven but that, but it intimates that it is our duty to make a business of it, and stir up all that is within us to it, and that in our present state of corruption and infirmity. It will not be done as it should be done without labor and struggle. We must take pains with our hearts to bring them and keep them to this work and to engage all that is within us. 3, here were, in compliance with the temper of that dispensation, a great variety of musical instruments used, harps, psalteries, cymbals, verses 1 and 6. And here was one that lifted up the horn, verse 5, that is, used wind music. The bringing of such concerts of music into the worship of God now is what none pretend to. But those who use such concerts for their own entertainment should feel themselves obliged to preserve them always free from anything that savors of immorality or profaneness by this consideration that time was when they were sacred and then those were justly condemned who brought them into common use. Amos 6:5. They invented to themselves instruments of music like David. 4, the glory and honor of God were principally intended in all this temple music, whether vocal or instrumental. It was to give thanks and praise the Lord that the singers were employed, verse 3. It was in the songs of the Lord that they were instructed, verse 7. That is, for songs in the house of the Lord, verse 6. This agrees with the intention of the perpetuating of psalmody in the gospel church, which is to make melody with the heart in conjunction with the voice unto the Lord, Ephesians 5:19. 5, the order of the king is likewise taken notice of, verse 2, and again verse 6. In those matters, indeed, David acted as a prophet, but his taking care for the due and regular observance of divine institutions, both ancient and modern, is an example to all in authority to use their power for the promoting of religion and the enforcing of the laws of Christ. Let them thus be ministers of God for good. 4, the fathers presided in this service. Asaph, He-Man, and Jeduthun, verse 1, and the children were under the hands of their father, verses 2, 3, and 6. This gives a good example to parents to train up their children and indeed to all seniors to instruct their juniors in the service of God and particularly in praising Him than which there is no part of our work more necessary or more worthy to be transmitted to the succeeding generations. It gives also an example to the younger to submit themselves to the elder, whose experience and observation fit them for direction, and, as far as may be, to do what they do under their hand. It is probable that Heman, Asaph, and Jeduthun were bred up under Samuel and had their education in the schools of the prophets, which he was the founder and president of. Then they were pupils. Now they came to be masters. Those that would be eminent must begin early and take time to prepare themselves. This good work of singing God's praises, Samuel revived and set on foot, but lived not to see it brought to the perfection it appears in here. Solomon perfects what David began, so David perfects what Samuel began. Let all in their day do what they can for God and his church, though they carry it so far as they would. When they are gone, God can out of stones raise up others who shall build upon their foundation and bring forth the top stone. 7. There were others also besides the sons of these three great men who are called their brethren, probably because they had been wont to join with them in their private concerts, who were instructed in the songs of the Lord, and were cunning or well skilled therein. Verse 7. They were all Levites and were in number 288. Now, 1. These were a good number and a competent number to keep up the service in the house of God, for they were all skillful in the work to which they were called. When David the king was so much addicted to divine poesy and music, many others, all that had a genius for it, applied their studies and endeavors that way. Those do religion a great deal of good service that bring the exercises of devotion into reputation. 2. Yet these were but a small number in comparison with the 4,000 whom David appointed thus to praise the Lord. Chapter 23, verse 5. Where were all the rest, when only 288, and those but by 12 in a course, were separated to this service? It is probable that all the rest were divided into as many courses and were to follow as these led, or perhaps these were for songs in the house of the Lord. Verse 6. With whom any that worshipped in the courts of that house might join, and the rest were disposed of, all the kingdom over, to preside in the country congregations in this good work. For though the sacrifices instituted by the hand of Moses might be offered but at one place, the psalms penned by David might be sung everywhere. 1 Timothy 2:8. Regarding verses 8 to 31, 24 persons are named in the beginning of this chapter as sons of these three great men: Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun. Ethan was the third, chapter 6, verse 44, but probably he was dead before the establishment was perfected, and Jeduthun came in his room. Or perhaps Ethan and Jeduthun were two names for the same person. Of these three, Providence so ordered it that Asaph had four sons, Jeduthun six, only five are mentioned, verse 3, Shimei, mentioned, verse 17, is supposed to have been the sixth, and Heman 14 in all 24 who were named, verses 2 to 4, who were all qualified for the service and called to it. But the question was, in what order must they serve? This was determined by lot to prevent strife for precedency, a sin which most easily besets many that otherwise are good people. 1. The lot was thrown impartially. They were placed in 24 companies, 12 in a company, in two rows, 12 companies in a row, and so they cast lots, ward against ward, putting them all upon a level, small and great, teacher and scholar. They did not go according to their age, or according to their standing, or the degrees they had taken in the music schools, but it was referred to God. Verse 8, small and great, teachers and scholars, stand alike before God, who goes not according to our rules of distinction and precedency. See Matthew 20, 23. 2. God determined it as he pleased, taking account, it is probable, of the respective merits of the persons, which are of much more importance than seniority of age or priority of birth. Let us compare them with the preceding catalogue, and we shall find that Josephus was the second son of Asaph, Gedaliah the eldest son of Jeduthun, Zakur the eldest of Asaph, Izri the second of Jeduthun, Nethaniah the third of Asaph, Bukiah the eldest of Heman, Jesharelah the youngest of Asaph, Jeshiah the third of Jeduthun, Mattaniah the second of Heman, Shimei the youngest of Jeduthun, Azariel the third of Heman, Hashabiah the fourth of Jeduthun, Shebel the fourth of He-Man, Mattathiah, the fifth of Jeduthun, Jeremoth, the fifth of He-Man, Hananiah, the sixth of He-Man, Joshbekasha, the 11th of He-Man, Hanani, the 7th of He-Man, Malothi, the 12th of He-Man, Eliatha, the 8th of He-Man, Hothir, the 13th of He-Man, Gedalti, the 9th of He-Man, Mahazioth, the 14th of He-Man, and lastly, Romanti Etzer, the 10th of He-Man. See how God increased some and preferred the younger before the older. Three, each of these had in his chorus the number of 12, called their sons and their brethren, because they observed them as sons and concurred with them as brethren. Probably 12, some for the voice and others for the instrument, made up the concert. Let us learn with one mind and one mouth to glorify God, and that will be the best concert. So there you go. I think that was pretty straightforward. Some of the sentence structuring by Matthew Henry, a bit more complicated than what is typical in our day, but that's all right. That is all right. There's something very beautiful about his observations here regarding the putting in order of the music. It's not just play whatever you want, however you want, whoever wants to, a coalition of the willing. No, it's a coalition of the called. And there's going to be a hierarchy to it, not just in the sequence by which we decide how the teams are going to be ordered, what sequence the teams here are going to be serving. That's handled by lot, which even that is not random and it's not chaotic because God is controlling how the dice rolls. But when it comes to the skillfulness, that's a priority. Also, the hierarchy is decided based on who is son of who or who is the father over who. We have fathers here leading, and that's pretty amazing. We have not everybody, not every father having as many sons. We have some here who have quite a lot of sons. I mean, 14 is a lot of sons. You think I have a lot of sons? 14? He-Man indeed. But there's an orderliness to it. There's a emphasis on virtue about it. And surely this music was awesome to listen to. It must have been amazing. I have no idea what it sounded like, but I wonder what it sounded like to have fathers leading sons, older men leading younger men, there having been an intentionality and an equipping like they had been to the academy that specializes in training excellent musicians. Was this like an orchestra? Was this like a jazz band? Was it like what? I don't know, but maybe someday we'll find out. Maybe someday we'll know what it sounded like. In any event, that's all for commenting on 1 Chronicles chapter 25. Let's delve into some current events items, including a fun one while we're on the subject of music. What if we were making modern praise and worship songs out of really obscure Bible passages that probably should not be sung, actually? Let's turn our attention now to our first bit of audio for this episode from a YouTube short, which I have also seen on Instagram as well, from a jazz pop fusion duo striving to be a light in Christian entertainment. They call themselves Zoetic, and they have some very funny little shorts like this one that I'm going to play, where they, I guess, pose the hypothetical. What if we were singing some verses in the Bible that maybe shouldn't be sung, or if they're going to be sung, maybe not in that style? Here it is, cut one, take a listen, and then I'll have some thoughts for you.
Two men fight together, and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him, and puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts. Then you shall cut off her hand. Your eyes shall not pity her. I shall not pity her.
What did I tell you? Yeah, that probably should not be a song that we sing in church. I'm just going to say that. I don't think that's one of those that needs to be put to music. I just don't think so. But it does, interestingly enough, highlight what we were talking about. It's a funny way of illustrating what we were just talking about with regards to 1 Chronicles chapter 25, where you have skillfulness, you have intentionality going into the business of making music. It's not just that you need to have skillful musicians. It does matter what you sing. And I don't have to say it. We all know it, or we should if we don't, that some of the lyrics to the most popular of mainstream Christian music numbers in the American church, some of the lyrics are not like this, right? Not like what I just played for you. Although that would be funny if we had more chart toppers that were like this. A lot of the lyrics are not necessarily edifying. I mean, they're not. And just because we sprinkle in some God talk and some biblical allusions or phrases, just because there is some mention of Jesus or biblical themes, or it's clean as far as, you know, there's no, oh, I don't know, talk of being a gangbanger and selling drugs and capping fools and how many prostitutes some big pimp, you know, is able to muster or whatever, and he's just rolling in the dough. Just because it doesn't have that sort of content in it, that doesn't mean that it's edifying. And I wish I didn't have to say that. I wish it went without saying. But unfortunately, a lot of the music that sells really, really well is very self-absorbed. And it's very emotivist. And it's very much more focused on creating a certain mood that is regarded as worshipful. And it's not necessarily either, one, cultivating Christian thought in the listener, or two, directing glory and awe and reverence towards God on the part of the listener. And so before we completely move on, I suppose, from the topic of music for this episode, it's worth noting another thing that Matthew Henry draws out or keys in on, no pun intended, in 1 Chronicles chapter 25, where the term prophecy is used in relation to music. That there would be a prophetic quality to the music is important. It's significant that there's a prophetic quality to it. Now, he speculates, because he's not sure either, I think he speculates intelligently about what maybe is meant by calling it prophecy or saying that there was prophesying going on through music. But he entertains a range of possibilities, one of which is that God was giving visions to these musicians as they were playing music. They were seeing and knowing things that were to come, future events that God was going to bring to pass that the people needed to be prepared for. And they needed to be ready, more to the point, to honor God in circumstances which were to come. They needed to be made wise, as in understanding. They needed to have a cultivation of Christian thought, we would say today. Back then, they wouldn't have necessarily said Christian thought, but godly thinking, righteous thinking. But they also needed to have an appreciation for the wonder and the majesty and the glory of God as to future events, some great and blessed, and others terrible to behold and scary. I mean, in a word, scary things that were going to happen that God was going to bring to pass to punish the wicked or to fulfill his promises to judge the nations. And the idea that instead of preferring the cultivation of Christian thought today, we would prefer to be rather more navel-gazing and emotivist and we would warble on about, you know, some basic themes that we just hit again and again and again, because the music sells when we talk about fire and we talk about water. When it's lost on a lot of listeners who are not steeped in Christian culture or churchy culture, even for those Christians who are steeped in it, it's more of an emotional thing, and it's not really engaging the mind to meditate on the things of God or the character of God or godly character that we're supposed to embody, then I think we need to do better. And I'm not trying to be a buzzkill. I'm not trying to be a fun sucker, or I'm not gunning for the church curmudgeon position when I get older. When I say this, we're missing out, and we want to do better so that we can have all that God has in store for us, and so that we can be and do what God has prepared for us to be and to do. But funny stuff, check out Zoetic, and maybe some of their other music will fit the bill, or some of their conversations around learning to play music well, educating themselves, speaking of getting an education in music. The one, at least, I see references to having gotten a degree in music. Check out their channel over at YouTube, and I think you'll be glad that you did. For more serious current events, though, dollar stores are shutting down across America. They did this to themselves. That's the headline from Nathaniel Meyerson over at CNN, as republished in the Billings Gazette, the, I think, biggest paper in Montana, my home state. Sometimes they, very often, they opt to just republish stuff from CNN and the AP. Here's an example of that. The headline says it all, doesn't it? New York, these are tough times, Nathaniel writes. For two big dollar store chains, in the past month, Family Dollar said it will close nearly 1,000 stores, and 99 Cents Only said it will go out of business. Both companies said inflation and shoplifting have contributed to their troubles. While inflation has pressured the company's low-income customer base and shoplifting has squeezed their profits, those factors alone can't explain their difficulties. Of course not. Years of strategic mistakes and underinvestment have plagued Family Dollar and 99 Cents Only, retail analysts say. Both brands were acquired by other companies and faltered under their new owners. Family Dollar has around 8,000 stores, mostly in cities, and the chain has struggled since Dollar Tree bought it in 2015 for $8.5 billion. Dollar Tree believed acquiring Family Dollar would help it compete against larger rivals, but it misjudged the deal. Now, we'll stop right there. We'll stop. That's enough. You can go read the full article if you want to, if you're so inclined, if you're very, very curious about why the dollar stores are shutting down and going the way of the dinosaur. It's not either or, and it's important to remember that. Single factor analysis, we have too much of that, in part, I think, because we rely too much on experts who are really, really good at one thing. It's good to have specialists, like with music, so also with economics, so also with journalism, so also with computer programming, so also with a whole lot of things. But we are preferring simple ways when we say it's only one thing that contributes to an outcome, either a good outcome or a bad outcome. It's only inflation. Oh, well, is inflation a major contributing factor? Perhaps the decisive contributing factor? I would say yes. I would say yes. I mean, and I say that just knowing how little a dollar buys anymore. What can you buy for a dollar? Well, that's the point. When the dollar stores can't sell items, they can't actually stock their shelves with things that you would actually sell for a dollar. And their whole branding, their whole marketing strategy revolved around selling things for a dollar. Then it becomes a bad joke to go to the dollar store and spend $1.99 or to spend $5 on something. Hey, this used to be, several short years ago, a dollar. Why is it not worth a dollar anymore? Well, because of inflation. But also, to the point that is being made by Nathaniel Meyerson over at CNN and peddled to the masses in the Rocky Mountains region by the Billings Gazette, mismanagement of the company can also contribute. And I think on a personal level, where my family has struggled financially in recent years, this is something I've really had to grapple with. I think a lot of us need to grapple with this, especially as inflation is still deeply rooted in our economic conditions. And I believe that's because of the regulatory environment. That's because of tax rates. That's because of the policies that are preferred by the folks who are actually in positions of governmental authority, civil authority right now. Inflation's not going away anytime soon. And so insofar as everything gets more expensive, except perhaps our labor, what we're compensated for in the way of wages for the work that we do, when everything else is getting more expensive faster than our wages are going up, we need to consider soberly what can be improved in our management of our households. If you own a business, yeah, you've still got to figure out how to manage your business well, how to run the business wisely, how to manage the money, but also how to make strategic decisions. If you manage a household, if you have your own personal budget, your family has a budget, you need to be thinking about where can we trim. For instance, I'm going to trim our subscription to the Billings Gazette. And while I'm talking about the Billings Gazette and canceling the subscription, speaking of inflation, they've raised the cost of a subscription monthly 3 times since I became a subscriber. And most recently, they started charging $31 a month. I don't pay $31 a month for any subscription. And it's a bad joke that they think their subscriptions are worth so much more than some of the other outlets that I have much more affection for and much more respect for. The Wall Street Journal doesn't charge $31 a month. The Epoch Times doesn't charge $31 a month. The Daily Wire doesn't charge $31 a month, and they deliver far more value to me in the way of helping me to stay informed on current events, helping me to understand what's going on in our country and around the world. And so I'm going to drop the Billings Gazette subscription. But here's how they get you. And this is, you know, one of those decisions that companies can make, and they are a company, even though they do journalism, they're a corporation, or they're part of a corporation. When you go to their website, because that's all I engage with, they don't deliver the physical newspaper to our house down here in Colorado. I just do the digital edition. When you go to their website and you try to cancel your subscription, they say, oh no, you have to call this number. Why is that? Because they want to make it harder for you to cancel, even if it just means you're like, ah, whatever, fine. I'll just keep the subscription for another month, or I'll call on Monday, and then you don't, and you forget to. You know, even if it's just one more month of subscription dues that they get out of you, then cool. You know, they still made that much more money. But when you try to call, say, for instance, when you're off work for the day or on the weekend, you get an automated message saying, oh, our business hours are Monday through Friday from blah, 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 8 a.m. You can tell I haven't been paying enough attention, and this is why I haven't canceled them over the last 2 months or whatever it's been since I decided I was going to cancel, especially after I saw the charges and that they had just gone up. I call and I get the automated message, and it says, yesterday at 4:30 when I called, our business hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. or whatever, until 4 o'clock. And it's like, you know, if you just close down your office building and don't ever allow anybody to actually call in and cancel their subscriptions, if you just lay off all your staff and republish CNN pieces and Associated Press articles, you could make a pretty handsome profit. Yeah, that's one way to run your business. But rest assured, next chance I get, I'm going to cancel. In part, I'm never going to resubscribe because of these shenanigans. And that comes down to how is a company, how is a corporation managing their business? Also, we as individuals and individual households have to make decisions, thinking short-term or thinking long-term. What are we paying for things? What are we charging for things? Where are we investing our time and our attention and our resources so as to derive the most benefit? What are we focused on, and are we making good decisions? It's not just inflation is this macro thing. Yeah, it is, and it poses a lot of challenges, but we still, and maybe all the more, have to be honest if we're holding on to a subscription that just doesn't deliver enough value and maybe just needs to be nixed. It just needs to go away. Hey, I don't need to pay that every month. I don't use that service. Let's let it go. Let's lower our costs in this regard. Hey, instead of buying this brand, let's buy that brand. Instead of shopping at this store for these things, let's do a comparison. And my wife actually recently did this. Do a comparison of what our common food items cost per pound or per ounce or per unit, whatever it is, at King Soopers, at Walmart, at Sam's Club, at Costco, at Natural Grocers, et cetera, and therefore, when we need to buy these things, we get them from here. When we need to buy these things, we get them from here. If we see a sale and it's this much per unit, or it's this much off, or it's buy one, get one free, we know, okay, we don't typically buy this here, but we're going to this time because that's a good deal. That's a better deal than what is on offer from the place we typically get it. You have to do those sorts of things. Just a word of encouragement, as much as I'm talking about inflation and our economic conditions being not so good or very challenging compared to what they were several years ago, and this due to macro decisions being made by the political class. As much as that's true and that's valid, and you do have to watch that, nevertheless, maybe all the more, you have to be minding your business where you are going to make the decision on the micro. You have to be minding that. I have to be minding that. The Family Dollar and 99 cents only stores, if they weren't, or if they couldn't help it because their whole marketing strategy, their whole branding strategy became obsolete because nothing costs just a dollar anymore, well then, that's a sobering thought, but let's not brush it off just because we don't like the way we feel when we think about it. There are hard decisions that only get harder if the trend is in the unhappy direction, the longer you put off making them. And so just face it and learn to be satisfied with having made a wise decision that was a hard decision sooner than later, and enjoying the benefits of making the right decision, the wise decision, for as long as possible thereby. Speaking of having to pinch pennies or dollars or whatever the next minimum unit of measurement will be currency-wise, Naveen Athrapulli reports for the Epoch Times, 2025 Social Security COLA estimate rises due to inflation. There are concerns the cost of living adjustment hike won't help in countering elevated prices, thus putting beneficiaries in a financially challenging position. The reporting here at the Epoch Times quotes TSCL, the March CPIW, Consumer Price Index for urban wage earners and clerical workers, came in at 3.5%. That was their April 10th press release. Quote, that's higher than the inflation trends indicated last month based on February's CPIW data. Based on this trend, the Senior Citizens League, that is what TSCL stands for, by the way, is adjusting the long-term forecast COLA to 2.6% in 2025. End quote. Naveen Athrapulli reports, the 2024 senior survey conducted by TSCL found that 43% of respondents saw their expenses jump by more than $185 per month last year. Per month is quite a lot, especially on a fixed income. When we're talking about older people, when we're talking about senior citizens, we're probably talking for the most part about people who already know how to budget. They know what things have cost, and if it's not an option for them to just make more by working overtime, what are they going to do to make up the difference? Well, you spend $185 less on something or several somethings, but only to a certain point. And so it's good that if they're relying on Social Security, if they were told in their young adult years that they would be paying into Social Security and it would be there for them when they retired, then it makes sense that it would be there and that it would be adjusted upwards. But then what would be even better than adjusting it upwards to keep up with inflation would be to make better decisions about how we manage the economy, and also to make better decisions about how individuals prioritize their relationship with family. This is one of the biggest problems in America over the last century. I'm convinced. The more I study, the more I read, the more I think about it, the more I look around, the more I observe who does better than whom, the more convinced I am that the messaging to everyone has been, be selfish. You don't have an obligation, if you don't want to have an obligation, to your children. You don't have an obligation, if you don't want to your spouse. You don't have an obligation, if you don't want to your parents. If you ask me, we should say, here's the cutoff date for Social Security. And after that point, it will not be available for people who are retiring. And therefore, you need to get to work on making a strong extended family safety net where you have been maybe for generations, we have been for generations, expecting that Social Security is going to be there because it's headed for complete insolvency. Our government writ large is headed for complete economic collapse if we don't do something about entitlements, if we don't do something about what we spend on providing for people with the taxpayers' money, and we just say we need to tax more and more or print money out of thin air, and that drives inflation, regulate more and more, collect the fines, use those fines that are collected to do still more regulating and more monitoring for compliance. If we don't do something about how much importance we've assigned to the civil government and how little, less and less and less, generation over generation, we have assigned to the role of extended families and local communities and churches. If we don't do something about that soon, it's all going to completely collapse. And then it won't be a choice. Nobody wants to make the choice. Nobody wants to talk about that if they're running for political office, if they're in political office and they hope to get reelected and stay in office. Nobody wants to talk about doing something with regards to entitlements, but it has to be that we reform and we make the hard decision sooner so that the hardest decisions are not just forced on us in a time of the circumstances choosing. The good Lord's providence is not to be underestimated. His ruling and reigning over the affairs of men is not to be ruled out, and we shouldn't just talk in terms of processes, but insofar as he's a God of order, and he's put the universe in order, and he's given us his precepts and his commands in Scripture, and he's told us what is good, that we would do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with our God, we are not doing good to have so much reliance on the government from cradle to grave. A conversation that we've been having in my household here recently is, especially as both my father and my wife's father are getting older and they're having some health issues over the last year that are concerning to us, if one of them goes in for surgery and they need to be on bed rest or they need to be really taking it easy for several weeks as they recover from surgery, that's very difficult to do anything about if they live on the exact opposite side of Greeley, or if they live on the opposite side of the country. And so what does it look like, especially as costs of living are going up and up, not just for us, but for them, what does it look like in the coming years? When should we start to figure out some other housing arrangement whereby they can come and live with us? And if they have health issues, if they need to be taking it easy because they've had an operation, they've had a procedure done, they're feeling sick, whatever, we're right here. And we can help, and we can take care of them in their old age. This used to be, and I think for most of human history, this was the expectation. And insofar as we've shifted the reliance away from the family unit, not just immediate family, not just the nuclear family, you know, mom, dad, kids, but the extended family, we've forgotten that this is actually how it's supposed to be. This is how it should be. Even in the case of the New Testament talking about taking care of widows, you know, in my wife's and my case, we're talking about our fathers who are getting older and they're both retired. But even in the case of a widow who is a true widow and she is over 60 years of age, she's got good character, she's got a good way of relating to the church, she invests in other people, she pays attention to the needs of other people, she serves and loves the people in the church and in the community, first the church, then the community writ large. if she has family, if she has extended family that lives nearby or anywhere she can reach them, it's their responsibility first and foremost. That's what Paul says when he gives requirements for the care of widows. And so I look at this cost of living adjustment, $185 per month, expenses going up for senior citizens. And I think the obvious answer, the obvious solution is you have elderly parents moving in with their adult children and hopefully grandchildren. And hopefully if we've been having kids at ideal or more ideal times, like closer to the age of 20 and not necessarily closer to the age of 40, you have maybe three generations in a household who can work together to help and support one another. That's how it used to be. That's how it should be. That's how it's going to have to be, I think, in short order. A difficulty arises where you have elderly people who either didn't have any children or they had very few children, and those children have not done very well economically. They're not financially secure themselves. Maybe they don't have real stable housing arrangements, or they don't have enough room in their house. You know, that gets to be a challenge. It also gets to be a challenge if there are children, adult children for elderly people, and there's not a good relationship there. There's upset about things that happened in childhood, or they became estranged once the adult children became adults. They just stopped talking to their parents who are now elderly, and now it's the last thing in the world anybody wants to do in this arrangement. In this scenario where they have this strained relationship, to have the elderly parent move in with their adult child. But guess what? Rather than avoiding those kinds of problems, we need to be figuring out what makes those situations work. If there is a strained relationship between elderly parents and adult children, then maybe, especially as we're going into difficult times economically, more and more difficult times economically, it seems like, with each passing month and each passing year for the last several years, maybe even since my wife and I got married. You know, the housing bubble collapsed, the economy went into a recession, the big banks got bailed out, and private individuals suffered joblessness, homelessness, evictions, quite a lot of disruption to their mode of life. And they haven't necessarily ever recovered or picked back up where they left off. It behooves us to mend broken relationships. And God is in the business of showing us how to do that because he has mended the relationship with us through Christ. And if we don't believe that, well, perhaps that's where we start. He loved us first, and so we love because he first loved us. If we don't recognize the love of God and the mercy of God in relation to us, then maybe that's where we need to start. And then we'll have the right calibration to be able to have the conversation with either adult children in the case of those who are elderly or elderly parents in the case of those adults who are seeing their parents getting older and older. Now, to be clear, just in case I'm giving maybe an accidental false impression here, when it comes to my dad, Lauren's dad, not living with us right now, it's not the case. It's not the case that... We don't already have that kind of a living arrangement because I'm upset with my dad. Lauren's upset with her dad. It's not like that. It's quite simply the economic conditions that we've been trying to make the best of and we've been hoping would change writ large on the macro for years. I mean, if I had my druthers, we would own a big, beautiful house out in the country and it would be no sweat at all to say, hey, come live with us. You know, maybe it starts as a spare bedroom and we say, hey, come on out and stay with us for a little while. And you try it out and you say, hey, this is pretty nice. I wish I didn't have to go home. I wish this was home. Okay, cool. Yeah, let's make that happen. Just move here. Just move in with us. Such as it is, we rent a house that is 2,500 square feet. There are 11 persons in our household and there is not really the spare room for inviting my dad or my wife's dad to come and live with us. And so one of the things that we're talking about right now is there some property that we could rent here in the area or somewhere? If we rented it together with them and they had less in the way of monthly expenses for housing, but it helped us to get into a bigger house that would have room for them to live with us, one or both of them. You know, if we start thinking in that direction now, then maybe we see an opportunity at a certain point and we jump on it and we say, hey, how about now? But that cost of living is going up is no secret. How much it's going up and what to do about it, that's where the difficulties lie. That's where we've got to do some figuring out. But I appreciate, in contrast to the piece at the Billings Gazette, which really originally came from CNN, I like that this piece of reporting at the Epoch Times is saying the cost of living is going up due to inflation instead of Social Security COLA estimate rises because the people relying on Social Security just don't know how to manage their money. You know, they just got a little crazy. All of them did by $185 a month. No, it's that everything that they were typically getting, all of their necessities, went up by $185 a month on average. And this is one of the reasons why I'm canceling the Billings Gazette subscription just as soon as I can. And I'm going to hold on to the Epoch Times as long as I can. But let's get into our last subject, and we'll spend the remainder of our time discussing several news items related to this, the Arizona situation. I'm going to play for you cut two and some audio from Arizona in the Arizona legislature. Here's what it sounded like very recently, as of this past week, actually, as Democrats yelled at Republicans in the state legislature over this question of abortion. Take a listen. And that's enough. It goes on for a while, but you get the idea. Okay, why were they yelling this? As LifeNews.com shared the video to their X account, their Twitter account, the irony, they write, is Democrats are the ones who support killing people. Breaking, Democrats yell at Republicans in the Arizona legislature, shouting blood on your hands after the court upholds a pro-life law. From the AP, quote, the Arizona legislature devolved into shouts of shame, shame on Wednesday as Republican lawmakers quickly shut down discussion on a proposed repeal of the state's newly revived 1864 law that criminalizes abortion throughout pregnancy unless a woman's life is at risk, end quote. So that's what it is. Republicans in Arizona said, no, we're not going to repeal this law. And the Democrats lost it. They are really upset. They are big mad. Quote, House Democrats and at least one Republican tried to open discussion on a repeal of the 1864 abortion ban, which holds no exceptions for rape or incest. GOP leaders, who command the majority, cut it off twice and quickly adjourned for the week. Outraged Democrats erupted in finger-waving chants of shame, shame, Republican State Rep. Teresa Martinez of Casa Grande said there was no reason to rush the debate. She accused Democrats of, quote, screaming at us and engaging in extremist and insurrectionist behavior on the House floor, end quote. The GOP-led Senate briefly convened without debate on abortion. Here's another quote from Harris Rigby's post about this at Not the Bee. We are navigating an extremely complex, emotional, and important area of law and policy, said Martinez, the GOP House Whip. Quote, in my opinion, removing healthy babies from healthy mothers is not health care nor reproductive care. Pregnancy is not an illness. It should be celebrated. It is an abortion that terminates life, end quote. And that's exactly right. And the Republicans in the state of Arizona have it exactly right, as far as it goes, except for the one who perhaps was going to try and bring this to a vote to repeal that law. If shame should be on anyone, it should be on that Republican or any Republican like that Republican, and shame should be on the Democrats. This is not the way to make decisions together. This is not how to handle business. But more than that, more importantly, this is not how we should be relating to the youngest and most innocent of our people. What the Democrats are demanding, and some Republicans are very willing, very ready to grant, is that innocent babies would be butchered as they have been for the last 50 years, in full view of the public, in full view of the law, and that that would be protected, and that that would be called sacred ground, and that that would be called a right. It is not right. It is tremendously evil. It is heinous. And as far as I'm concerned, to cave to the Democrats on this issue anywhere is to hollow out the legitimacy of the Republican cause. To say we're going to be a nation ruled by laws instead of men, unless the Democrats get really upset, unless they engage in histrionics, unless they disrupt normal business with shouting, with screaming, with ugly remarks, with threats, in which case we'll just let them have whatever they want, is to say that we're not a nation ruled by law. Or in the case of the state of Arizona, that Arizona would not be a state governed by law, that it would just be whoever yells the loudest. And you know that this does not work in both directions equally. You know that it is a one-way street, and that if and when Republicans act like these Democrats are, it's called a threat to our democracy by the media, which wants the Democrats to win and wants only the kind of Republicans who let the Democrats win. We know that if Republicans, if conservatives, in opposition to what the Democrats are demanding, yell right back, or if they disrupt, or if they protest, or if they in any way impede the Democrats, it will be dealt with harshly and severely. And if the Democrats do this, it's called a robust, vibrant democracy. And quite simply, there's no way to explain it except that man has a sinful nature, and some people want to ratify the sinful nature instead of ratifying the laws of God in the laws of our land. There's a lawlessness to this. And I agree with LifeSite News' summary that the irony is Democrats are the ones who support killing people. They're demanding that the killing must go on. It must proceed. How dare you tell us no? We'll do worse to you. That's the sentiment from Democrats. They say, blood on your hands. No. The exception is already there in the 1864 law, as the AP reports, for the life of the mother, in which case I think we don't call it an abortion if, say, a woman has an ectopic pregnancy. And my wife tragically had one of these just a few short years ago. It was very, very upsetting. It was very heartbreaking for us. I caught my wife as we were trying to come into the hospital and get checked in. She collapsed and convulsed because the ectopic pregnancy had ruptured. She had to be rushed into emergency surgery or else she was going to die. That wasn't an abortion. That wasn't an abortion. And the folks who are trying to collapse these two categories are as dishonest as they are murderous. If murder is not something that they blush about, why would we think that rightly handling the word of truth even just in a general revelation sense, would be a priority. I don't, for one. And I resent deeply the insinuation that in the case of the life of the mother means if the mother just decides she doesn't want to raise a child right now, she wants to finish even high school or college. No, it's not a potential person. It's not you're going to be a mother unless you get an abortion. It's you're a mother right now. And we have to be clear about that. And we have to not be bullied and terrorized into silence about it. The Republicans, it looks like in the video feed here, get up and they just walk out. They look lost. They look bewildered. Like, what do we do? And they look around to each other like, hey, what do we do here? What do you think? Should we just wait for this to die down? It's not dying down. The Democrats are just going to abort the business of the day of the legislature because they're not getting what they want on this. And so the Republicans, one by one, just kind of filter off and they look uncomfortable. They look unsure of themselves. And I don't know what they should have done instead, but I know that this should not be retreated from because it only emboldens evil people who are insisting on running the country or running the state. It only emboldens them to act as though, yes, I am ashamed. You keep screaming shame, shame, shame at me. I am ashamed. I'm so ashamed. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking, trying to defend innocent life. If we're not about that, then what are we doing? You know, the Democrats carrying on like this are clearly not about that. But the Republicans, who are ready to give the Democrats whatever they want, as long as they have some modicum of peace, are not much better. What are you even there for if you're just going to cave to the Democrats on this? When you have the votes, what are you even there for? If the criminals make enough of a fuss, will you stop enforcing other laws too? Will you stop saying other types of violent crime should be resisted or punished by our civil authorities? In too many cases, the answer is yes, I think. But this is not the last news item for us to consider on this topic. Another bit of reporting at Not the Bee. Harris Rigby, April 12th, update, burrito boy sentenced to 7.5 years for firebombing Wisconsin pro-life clinic. On Wednesday, this is a quote, on Wednesday, the U.S. Attorney Office for the Western District of Wisconsin announced in a statement that Hrindindu Sankar Roy Chowdhury was sentenced to 7.5 years in federal prison for firebombing the headquarters of the Christian conservative pro-life activist organization Wisconsin Family Action in Madison, Wisconsin in May 2022. As Harris Rigby writes, Compass Care, the pro-life network that oversaw the bombed clinic, says the punishment doesn't fit the crime and that Burrito Boy's 7-year stay in prison isn't adequate. Why are we calling him Burrito Boy? Well, because that's how they figured out that he was the one who had firebombed the clinic, because he left a little bit of his DNA on a burrito wrapper at this site, at this crime scene. Quote, the sentencing would lead the public to believe this is a simple case of misguided arson instead of a political act representing a multinational Marxist revolution, end quote, stated Reverend Jim Hardin, Compass Care CEO. Additionally, Hardin expressed concern about, quote, the dearth of arrests and investigations of violent pro-abortion terror compared to the crushing DOJ-FBI persecution of peaceful pro-lifers during the exact same time frame, end quote. Harris Rigby continues, citing the fact that 6 pro-lifers in Nashville, Tennessee, are facing jail for up to 11 years and fined $250,000 for simply sitting in the doorway at an abortion mill. Reverend Hardin claims that this shows the hypocrisy of the Justice Department. It's not hypocrisy, it's a double standard, because they are Democrats. They're Democrats who have found their way into the highest offices of our government, and they absolutely are applying unequal weights and measures to get the outcome that is desired, which again is just another variation on the same theme of lawlessness. It's shameful that the Democrats in the Arizona legislature are screaming at Republicans, shame, shame, shame. But this takes it to another level. And this is, at a federal level, a double standard because the Democrats want abortion. And they don't want the pro-lifers seeming to get away with what, by comparison, was a relatively minor inconvenience. Property not destroyed. Instead of threatening violence, they were trying to stop violence. But apparently, the powers that be at a federal level, when the Democrats are in charge, like the violence, as long as it accomplishes what they want at the end of the day. And that's really abortion in a nutshell. We want the violence as long as it accomplishes what we want at the end of the day. As long as the ends are accomplished, then the means can be justified. It's true in the case of the firebombing of the clinic. It's true in the case of abortion. And it doesn't matter how innocent the victim is, as long as some claim can be made to greater happiness or prosperity or power for the Democrats. That's really what this boils down to. And the Republicans who are saying, yep, you can just have it, had better have a really, really good explanation. But I don't think they do. I'm sorry to say, I don't think they do. I think it's cowardice. And in too many cases, I think they also like abortion being legal because they're conservative along certain lines, say fiscal lines, and they agree that, yeah, if this safeguards my lifestyle choices or the lifestyle choices of my family, my friends, so that I can live my best life right now, I don't really care if innocent lives are destroyed in the most barbaric, cruel, inhuman, evil of ways, at scale, as they have been for the last 50 years. I don't really care. As long as I get to enjoy my life, I'm really not that concerned about the rule of law. But in that case, I say we have the wrong kind of Republicans, and we need a better kind of Republican who says this power is totally useless. Getting into political office, what's the point if I'm not going to, once there, actually uphold the rule of law and equal application of the laws and equal protection of the laws for the most innocent and vulnerable? It's so ironic, as many pro-lifers, as many abortion abolitionists have said in recent years, it's so ironic that everybody who's for abortion has already been born. How about that? It's that the folks who make these decisions at the end of the day don't worry that they themselves will be aborted, or they think that this is how they avoid getting aborted themselves or having their dreams of wealth and power aborted. It's that they make this decision because they're not actually going to suffer the consequences, or so they think. But there's a God in heaven who hates hands that shed innocent blood. He hates them. And he will judge this nation, this country, and everyone who's complicit in this, everyone who's silent on this and doesn't speak up as innocent men, women, and children are led away to the slaughter. It's everybody who doesn't speak up who will be complicit in the slaughter. It's everyone who actively engages or who tries to run interference and block those who would put a stop to it. They are complicit, and God will judge them. And they should know that. They should be warned about that. Those who are carrying out the evil deeds should be warned that God will not be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. It's not just a sin against the preborn child. And if the woman is pressured into it, if she's coerced into an abortion to try and protect whoever it was that was abusing her or took advantage of her, it's not just her who's being sinned against. It's God himself who's being sinned against. And again, God will not be mocked. The man reaps what he sows. Or a country reaps what the country sows. We've been sowing quite a lot of innocent bloodshed. When will it stop? It won't stop anytime soon if Carrie Lake is successful. Carrie Lake came out against yesterday's abortion ban in Arizona. Let me take a stab at explaining why John Knox writes for Not to Be. We told you yesterday that the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that an 1864 abortion ban can go into effect after the overturn of Roe v. Wade. We were kind of happy about it. Not everyone on the conservative side of the aisle had our same positive feelings about the law. Most prominent among them was Arizona Senate candidate Carrie Lake. Here we have her released statement. Carrie Lake, you'll remember, made quite a fuss in the 2020 election about not gaining the governorship of Arizona, and there was a lot of funny business in that. But here's her statement. Quote, I am the only woman and mother in this race. I understand the fear and anxiety of pregnancy and the joy of motherhood. I wholeheartedly agree with President Trump. This is a very personal issue that should be determined by each individual state and her people. I oppose today's ruling, and I am calling on Katie Hobbs and the state legislature to come up with an immediate common sense solution that Arizonans can support. Ultimately, Arizona voters will make the decision on the ballot come November. As your senator, I will oppose federal funding for abortion, federal bans on abortion. And she says a little bit more. She says, as your senator, I will fight for baby bonuses and making adoption more accessible and affordable. But this is an odd look. This is a really, really odd look. This needs to go to the states. The states need to decide. But in this case, you're opposed to the state Supreme Court's ruling. Isn't this the state deciding? Back to John Knox. He writes, I used to think pro-life meant that you wanted abortions outlawed. Lake not only opposes a federal abortion ban, the statement is a repudiation of an Arizona abortion ban. The pro-life Christian candidate in Arizona is asking the Democrat governor to reverse an abortion ban. There's an argument to be made that not every political office at every level needs to be engaged in the issue of abortion. This is Trump's argument. Let the president focus on national security, emergencies, foreign diplomacy, and let the issue of abortion turn back over to the states. This was the opposite of what happened during the Civil War, when the nation split and millions of brothers killed each other over a federal mandate on slavery. That's the reductionist version, I know. Trump knows that making the 2024 election about top-level abortion bans, now that Roe has been overturned and we, the people, are able to shift the battle to local and state laws, serves in the interest of Joe Biden, which is why Joe Biden is running daily attack ads about abortion in the hopes of turning out mass numbers of women. Trump and allies like Lake don't want the 2024 election to be about abortion. The vast majority of Americans support abortion limitations, but the vast majority also support abortion at reasonable levels. Not that killing babies could ever be reasonable, but I'm putting it in their perspective. Here's the argument. Quote, in a swing state like Arizona, if the election is about the border, inflation, jobs, security, and competence, Biden and the Democrats lose. If it is about abortion, there is a good chance Democrats win. And if Biden gets elected, it will be codified abortion and open borders, and there won't even be an America. Whatever replaces it will be a total abortion state. So, because Arizona's top court reverted back to a 160-year-old law, it will put abortion directly in the limelight. Trump, Lake, and others identify this as a threat. In addition, many who are more passionately pro-life than them understand that it would be better to have someone quasi-pro-life in office so pro-life leaders can get a ton accomplished in the background than to have the Abortion Without Limits candidate in office. Remember how France just codified abortion in its constitution? I'm not saying this will please Almighty God compared to complete and total abortion abolition, but simply that we are discussing shrewdness and political elections and why some, like Lake, are charting this course. Lake wasn't the only Republican beating that drum. Ben Zeisloft commenting on this is highlighted in a screenshot. Breaking, Rep. Cisco Manny, another Arizona Republican, says the Arizona Supreme Court decision allowing a ban on most abortions is, quote, a disaster for women and providers, end quote. Quote, I'm a strong supporter of empowering women to make their own healthcare choices, and I oppose a national abortion ban. The territorial law is archaic. We must do better for women, and I call on our state policymakers to immediately address this in a bipartisan manner, end quote. Yeah, that's a keep abortion legal statement. It's wild, but the Republican Party is really the big tent party now. You can't disagree with anything over in the Democrat camp. You must toe the line. Abortion for all or nothing. Over on the Republican side, there are many different points of view, and the tent is getting more diverse all the time compared with the diversity on the left. The question now, how to direct this bigger and bigger collective of people with differing views toward actual pro-life action without capitulating and becoming the party of Bill Clinton's safe, legal, and rare? How do we take our nation with a majority of people who support abortion and work like Wilberforce to make our laws reflect God's law? That scary Christian nationalism they keep talking about. There are major issues with this stance, both morally and factually. And here we have Matthew Gruss highlighted by Ben Zeisloft as well. Alert! At Matthew Gruss, a Republican in the Arizona House, said yesterday that the Arizona Supreme Court decision approving a ban on most abortions, quote, cannot stand, end quote. Quote, I categorically reject rolling back the clock to a time when slavery was still legal and where we could lock up women and doctors because of an abortion. I cannot and will not condemn women, especially the victims of rape or incest, to be forced to carry their pregnancy to term. We need a policy that protects the rights of women and protects new life. We need laws that respect women and the difficult decision to end a pregnancy in the early stages before the fetus can feel pain or live outside the womb, end quote. He called for a 15-week law with exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother, as well as protections for contraceptives and IVF. I agree with John Knox. There are major issues with this stance, both morally and factually. He compares the legalization of slavery to bans on abortion. That's backwards. If you think people who supported chattel slavery are the type of people who supported abortion bans, your worldview and understanding of history has gone screwy. I understand that abortion abolitionists will get angry about some of the nuance that I'm discussing here, and we're talking about the deaths of babies, so it's right to be angry. But how will we use that outrage? Peoples and their kings have had all sorts of difficult situations before them. How can they choose what is tactically expedient without sinning in the process? How can they be shrewd for God's glory, but in a way that doesn't lead to capitulation? I'm not defending everything in the statement of Lake or other Arizona Republicans, but I do want to extract the nuggets of wisdom in their arguments as we consider how to apply it. And that is John Knox's take on this over at Not the Bee. I'm going to disagree. Big tent or no big tent, hoping that abortion on demand candidates like Joe Biden won't be in office is not enough. If the kind of Republican we're going to get is going to be just more of the neocons who only agreed on being opposed to high taxes, high regulation, and the spread of communism. If the new crop of Republicans is going to codify Roe v. Wade because they think that's how you get elected, then it's no better than having the Democrats. Or it's not enough better. I can't agree with these Republicans. I can't. This is why I call myself an independent, because I don't have respect for Republicans like these. You know, it's one thing to just not make a statement, but you can't make no statement. You can't not make a statement. And so if you're going to make a statement, tell the truth, or at least don't lie. My concern here is it's half a dozen of one and six of the other. If we say this 1864 abortion ban is inhumane, but on the other hand, we're saying this should go back to the states. It should go back to the states, and we should lose there. Let's not continue losing at the federal level. Let's lose on a state-by-state basis. No, unacceptable. With that attitude, yeah, you will lose. And you're saying, oh, but there's no winning. Yeah, with that attitude, there is no winning. Now, I do like John Knox's take. I do agree with him, having recently read Amazing Grace by Eric Metaxas, all about William Wilberforce. We should be taking a cue from that book. I think also, too, if you remember, in the case of Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, nobody before him or after him has been so wise. When Solomon has the two prostitutes who each come to him claiming the other woman's baby died, the other woman is trying to steal their baby, what does Solomon do? He calls for someone to bring him a sword, and he's going to cut the baby in half, and he's going to give half to each of the women. There, problem solved. So he's playing stupid. That sort of shrewdness, I think, is a great idea. I think that's exemplary. Because the real mother, the one who really is the mother of this baby, who's going to take care of this baby, says, no. She can have this baby. Please don't do this thing. And then she's the one who gets the baby. The one who says, no, I'll give this baby up. Don't do this thing. Don't cut the baby in half. She's the one who gets the baby and gets to raise the child. We need that kind of shrewdness, not the kind of shrewdness that says, let's advance candidates. Let's back candidates who are going to say everything that the Democrats have been saying and just run as a Republican. No. Unacceptable. Find a better argument. Find a better tactic. If you want to say we need to be shrewd, yeah, that's not it. That's not shrewd to just have Democrats run as Republicans and then they'll win. Last up, let's consider Zach Jewell's reporting for the Daily Wire. Trump calls on Arizona governor, legislature to act immediately on abortion law. As Zach writes, former President Donald Trump took his criticism of Arizona's reinstated abortion ban a step further on Friday, calling on the state's Democratic governor and legislature to stop the 160-year-old law from taking effect. The 1864 law, which the state's high court ruled could go into effect, protects unborn children from abortion in every circumstance other than when the life of the mother is in danger. Anyone who aids an abortion is punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison, according to the law. Trump said in a statement to reporters on Wednesday that he believes the Arizona abortion law goes too far, adding, quote, "that will be straightened out," end quote. The former president took to his social media platform Truth Social on Friday to call on Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and state lawmakers, quote, "to remedy what has happened," end quote, and, quote, "act as fast as possible," end quote. Quote, "the Supreme Court in Arizona went too far on their abortion ruling, enacting and approving an inappropriate law from 1864. So now the governor and the Arizona legislature must use heart, common sense, and act immediately," all caps for emphasis in the original, "to remedy what has happened," end quote, Trump wrote. Quote, "remember, it is now up to the states and the goodwill of those that represent the people. We must ideally have the three exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. This is important. Democrats are the extremists. They support abortion up to the moment of birth and even execution of babies in some cases after birth. This should not be. Arizona legislature, please act as fast as possible," end quote. Now stop. Stop, 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 stop. If the personhood of the baby is not in question, then why do you carve out an exception for rape and incest? Is the person not a person, and when do they become a person if that's not true in the womb, if they were conceived in rape, or if they were conceived as a result of incest? If someone's mother was raped, and now they're going about in society, they're 20, 30, 40 years old, and their mother kept them and raised them and loved them, but this is how they were conceived in the first place, are they not a person? Is it just okay to murder them violently in the most barbaric of ways? I mean, look at what abortion is. It's not just evil when the baby has been born and you execute the baby, you murder the baby on the operating table. That is evil, but it's evil when it happens in the womb too. If it's evil when it happens on the operating table because the abortion provider can see what they're doing, but it's not evil as long as it happens in the womb, that they rip the limbs off, then is it not evil as far as we're concerned if we don't see it because it's happening in an abortion clinic on the other side of town or the next county over or the next state over? Is it not evil as long as we don't have to look at it, as long as we don't see it? Well, that's a foolish way to figure out what is and isn't evil. And that's a very similar sort of a way of deciding what is evil, what is tolerable, what we will put a stop to what the German people employed as millions of men, women, and children were loaded into cattle cars and transported to concentration camps in the 20th century. There to be worked to death, to be experimented on, to be tortured, to be brutalized, to be starved to death, to be shot, to be gassed, to be incinerated. As long as the people in the church could sing loud enough to not hear the cries for help as the train cars rolled by, they couldn't hear the evil either. If it's evil, it's evil. And being able to see it is not the decisive factor. Being able to hear it is not the decisive factor. I'm going to close out this episode reading Proverbs chapter 24. And let this sink in. If you're not sure how to come down on this issue, what conclusion to come to, let this sink in and contemplate it well and consider what the legacy of Wilberforce actually was. It wasn't just shrewdness and patience, and I'm going to keep on introducing this legislation again and again and again and again until it passes. He also engaged in a campaign. He participated and lent his credibility to a campaign to educate the public and the government of the UK on what slavery was, what the slave trade actually did to people, not just the slaves, but also those who owned slaves, those who transported the slaves. But here's Proverbs chapter 24 in the ESV. "Be not envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them, for their hearts devise violence, and their lips talk of trouble. By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. By knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. A wise man is full of strength, and a man of knowledge enhances his might. For by wise guidance you can wage your war, and in abundance of counselors there is victory. Wisdom is too high for a fool. In the gate he does not open his mouth. Whoever plans to do evil will be called a schemer. The devising of folly is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to mankind. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, "Behold, we did not know this," does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? My son, eat honey, for it is good, and the drippings of the honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is such to your soul. If you find it, there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Lie not in wait as a wicked man against the dwelling of the righteous. Do no violence to his home. For the righteous falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked stumbles in times of calamity. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and let not your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest Yahweh see it and be displeased and turn away his anger from him. Fret not yourself because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked, for the evil man has no future. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. My son, fear Yahweh and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise, for disaster will arise suddenly from them, and who knows the ruin that will come from them both. These also are sayings of the wise. Partiality in judging is not good. Whoever says to the wicked, "You are in the right," will be cursed by peoples, abhorred by nations. But those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. Whoever gives an honest answer kisses the lips. Prepare your work outside. Get everything ready for yourself in the field, and after that, build your house. Be not a witness against your neighbor without cause, and do not deceive with your lips. Do not say, "I will do to him as he has done to me. I will pay the man back for what he has done." I passed by the field of a sluggard, by the vineyard of a man lacking sense. And behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. Then I saw and considered it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. My friends, there's work to do. Be sober and vigilant, for your adversary the devil goes about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. God, save us. That's all the time I've got for this episode. I've got to run. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.
You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.